Welcome to the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine. Meet him, greet him, treat him, and street him. Today's date is June 30th, 2020, and I'm your skeptical host, Ken Milne. The title of today's podcast is TPA Advocates Be Like, Never Gonna Give You Up. And our guest skeptic is Professor Daniel Fadovich. He is an emergency physician and clinical researcher based at Royal Perth Hospital in Western Australia. He is the head of the Center for Clinical Research in Emergency Medicine, Harry Perkins Institute of Medical Research, professor of emergency medicine, University of Western Australia, and director of research at Royal Perth Hospital. Welcome to the SGEM, Daniel.
Thanks very much, Ken. It's wonderful to be on your show and have the opportunity to be a guest skeptic with you.
Well, I think the honor's mine because I've been a fan of your writing and your thinking for many, many years. So it's a real honor to have you on the SGEM as the guest skeptic.
Well, that's very kind, Ken. I always think of the quote by Isaac Newton, which says, if I see into the distance, it's because I stand on the shoulders of giants. And, you know, I've listened to the same giants of emergency medicine as you have, predominantly the Rick and Jerry show. And just being exposed to all those, what I call the thinkers of emergency medicine, has really helped expand my mind and helped get me to where I am today.
Well, I wanted to highlight one of my all-time favorite papers that you were part of, and it's the one called Don't Just Do Something, Stand There, The Value and Art of Deliberate Clinical Inertia. So before we get started on today's critical appraisal, could you briefly explain the concept that you discussed in this really, really important paper?
Thanks, Ken. Doctors have a bias to intervene in medicine, which is called intervention bias. We always feel compelled to do something for the patient, for example, a test. Although we understand that no test is perfect, patients tend to believe that investigations and treatments are always beneficial. Doing is superficially valued more than thinking. So deliberate clinical inertia is the art of doing nothing as a deliberate positive response. So it's reframing doing nothing as doing something and promoting the concept that less is more. And I also make the point that most quality indicators promote doing something, and wouldn't be innovative to reverse that QI thinking so we measured how often we did nothing.
Oh, I think that would be brilliant to see a guideline come out with a level A recommendation saying, just stand there, don't do something. Wow. Wow. Yeah, we do have this bias and we want to do something. We want to help. I mean, back in being interviewed for medical school, we didn't say, geez, I want to stand by and see what happens. We said, we want to help people, but we have to realize that helping people sometimes means standing there. So I will put a link in the show notes so people can read this paper, and I would encourage them to do so because it is just a fantastic article to read and get your head around and think about adopting some new concepts. Anyways, pre-COVID time there, Daniel, we had the pleasure, and I say we because it was my wife, Barb, and I had the pleasure of having dinner with you at your home with some very special friends. It was a unique dinner because you've been doing this thing with this group of friends for a number of years, and it was one of the highlights that we had for our whole trip to Australia was spending an evening with you and your friends. Can you tell us a little bit about what you and your friends have done? And I think it's a great concept for wellness.
Well, basically, it's a group of close colleagues from various cities around Australia, and we typically meet up at our annual college conference. And one night we have what's called a professor's dinner. And not everybody is actually a professor, but it's just a great get together where we catch up with good people, good food, good wine, and just really enjoy each other's company. And certainly for Shauna and myself, it was wonderful to be able to share that local hospitality with you.
Well, I can confirm it was good wine, good food, and very good company. But let's get on with today's episode. So you've brought me a case. What case do you have for today's SGEM episode?
So a 65-year-old man arrives from home to the emergency department by EMS with right-sided weakness beginning about 3 hours previously. Advanced neuroimaging demonstrates he does not qualify for endovascular clot retrieval. He's got a National Institute of Health stroke severity score of 11 and no contraindications for thrombolysis.
Thrombolysis for acute ischemic stroke has been one of, if not the most, controversial subjects of my career. The debate dates back to that classic NINS paper published in the New England Journal of Medicine, 1995. And we reviewed that publication with Dr. Anand Swaminathan on SGEM number 70.
Well, it's actually an issue that I've been writing about for years, if not decades, and I've described it as the gift that keeps on giving. Some people might argue that it's less relevant now because of endovascular clot retrieval, but I see it as a living example of issues to do with research methodology, critical appraisal, bias, conflicts of interest, etc. And these are elements that are continuously present in medicine. Just look at all the recent COVID-19 literature, which I think has been made worse by all those preprint archive releases of un-peer-reviewed papers.
It was Dr. Jerome Hoffman that introduced me to this issue and was a basis of my skepticism. I used to think that if a study was published in a high-impact journal, it must be true. But his mentorship and teaching are why I consider Dr. Hoffman a legend of emergency medicine.
Well, Ken, I can only agree with you, and I have to confess to a very similar experience. And I am embarrassed to say that I used to believe everything I read, just the same as you. How wrong I was. Jerry has certainly had an extraordinary impact on our practice and thinking in emergency medicine.
Well, we've covered the issue of thrombolysis for acute ischemic stroke a number of times on the SGEM, and I've also published a review on the topic of thrombolytics for stroke beyond 3 hours with my best friend, Dr. Chris Carpenter. More recently, I published a pro-con debate on the subject with my BEAM friend, Dr. Eddie Lang, looking at the evidence.
There's been a lot of skepticism about thrombolysis in acute ischemic stroke since the beginning, since 1995. A reanalysis of the NINS study by Jerry Hoffman and David Schreiger was published in Annals of Emergency Medicine in 2009. And I would say the major takeaway from that reanalysis was that it was the baseline imbalance in stroke severity that led to the difference in outcomes. If TPA really works, we should see a bigger change in the stroke severity score in the TPA group versus the placebo group. Yet the difference was 0.0. People often forget that a clinical trial has internal validity if and only if the imbalance between groups, bias in the assessment of outcome, and chance have been excluded as possible explanations for the difference in outcomes. In fact, baseline imbalance is a pretty recurring theme. So replication studies are hugely important.
And it was that NINS trial back in 1995 that changed practice guidelines and practice itself to provide thrombolysis in patients with stroke symptoms less than 3 hours after onset. This despite multiple other trials that did not show efficacy and reported increased harm, i.e. bleeding. The increase in adverse events prompted some to be even stopped early.
So the only other randomized control trial that says that there is benefit for a primary outcome was ECAS-3. So ECAS-1 and 2 did not show a benefit with thrombolysis, but ECAS-3 reported a 7% absolute benefit of improved modified Rankin score at 90 days compared to placebo, with a 9% increase in intracranial hemorrhage and a 2% increase in symptomatic intracranial hemorrhage and no significant difference in mortality.
The American College of Emergency Physicians, or ACEP, is the largest organization of EM physicians in the world. ACEP has a clinical policy statement on the issue, this is Brown et al., back in 2015, and they looked at the under 3-hour time frame and the 3 to 4.5 hour time frame. They made no A recommendations, but they did make B and C recommendations, and I'll include those recommendations for you to review in the show notes.
So ECAS 3 was published in 2008. Just recently, 12 years later, there's a reanalysis of the trial similar to the NINS reanalysis, which was done 14 years after the original NINS trial.
So what's the clinical question we're going to try to answer on today's episode?
So the clinical question is thrombolysis for acute ischemic stroke in the 3 to 4.5-hour time frame post-onset safe and effective?
And so we always like to mention the reference. And was this published in the same high-impact journal that the original ECAS-3 trial was published in?
No, so ECAS-3 was published in the New England Journal of Medicine. And this reanalysis by Alper et al. Was published in BMJ Evidence-Based Medicine.
So let's run through the PICO. What was the population for the ECAS-3 trial?
So this was adult patients aged 18 to 80 years of age with at least 30 minutes of acute ischemic stroke symptoms presenting between 3 and 4.5 hours after onset of the symptoms with no significant improvement.
And there was a long list of exclusions, and I think it's important for people to know about the exclusions, so I'll post those in the show notes as well. What was the actual intervention?
Before I go to the intervention, and yes, there is a long list of exclusions, but it's really important to highlight that there are things in there like previous stroke and diabetes. That's a real highlight. The intervention was TPA, 0.9 milligrams per kilo, with an initial 10% bolus and the remainder over 60 minutes.
And they compared that to a placebo. What was the primary outcome?
So the primary outcome was the modified Rankin score of 0 to 1, which is considered favorable, versus a modified Rankin score of 2 to 6, which was unfavorable, done at 90 days.
And how about secondary outcomes?
Oh, look, there was a range of secondary outcomes, including Bartel Index, the National Institute of Health Stroke Severity Score, Glasgow Outcome Scale, mortality, intracerebral hemorrhage, etc.
All right, let's get to the author's conclusions. The authors of this reanalysis of ECAS-3, quote, reanalysis of ECAS-3 trial data with multiple approaches adjusting for baseline imbalances does not support any significant benefit and continues to support harm for the use of alteplase 3 to 4.5 hours after stroke onset. Clinicians, patients, and policymakers should reconsider interpretations and decisions regarding the management of acute ischemic stroke that were based on ECAS-3 results. End of quote. Now, Daniel, can you just remind us, what were the original ECAS-3 authors' conclusions?
So not surprisingly, Ken, they were quite different. So the original ECAS-3 conclusions were, as compared with placebo, intravenous alteplase administered between 3 and 4.5 hours after the onset of symptoms significantly improved clinical outcomes in patients with acute ischemic stroke. Alteplase was more frequently associated with symptomatic intracranial hemorrhage.
So there's a little bit of dissonance there. You know, they both agree on the harm side, but there's a divergent on the interpretation as to the benefit. All right, let's go through the quality checklist for randomized trials. So the first question is, did the study population include or focus on those in the emergency department?
Yes.
Did they adequately randomize the patients?
Yes.
Did they conceal the randomization?
Yes.
Did they do an intention to treat analysis?
Yes, they did.
The patients were recruited consecutively, i.e. there was no selection bias.
It's not really clear in the paper, so I've said it's unsure. I actually did a little bit of a maths calculation because it was almost a 4.5-year study at 130 sites, which enrolled 821 patients, which is 6.3 patients per site, which is about 1.5 patients per site per year. Now, I know in a multi-center trial, not everybody is recruiting for the whole period of time, but it's hard to believe that it was consecutive patients with those kinds of numbers. Also, initially, they were only recruiting between 3 and 4 hours, but then they extended that to 4.5 hours because after a pooled analysis done at 228 patients, indicated that patients may, or to quote you, may not benefit up to 4.5 hours, and recruitment was slow, so it was a way of increasing recruitment.
I like that last part. And we're not getting enough patients, so why don't we just push it out another half an hour? I think the recruitment was slow may have had an impact. All right, question number 6. The patients in both groups were similar with respect to prognostic factors.
Well, the answer is no. The placebo group had a higher median stroke severity score, and there was more in the placebo group with a previous stroke, which are obviously two very important factors that contribute to outcome.
How about all participants? Were they unaware of their group allocation?
Yes.
Were they treated equally except for the intervention of the TPA?
Yes.
Did they have good follow-up?
Yes.
Were all patient important outcomes considered?
Yes.
And the 11th and final question, the treatment effect, was it large enough and precise enough to be clinically significant?
Well, no, because the reanalysis by ALPERS says does not support any significant benefits and continues to support harms. I also know from another analysis where when you readjust the primary outcome that dichotomizes the modified Rankin scale from 0 to 1 versus 2 to 6 and change it to 0 to 2 versus 3 to 6, you get there's no statistical difference between the two. The other point that I've just looked up today, a lot of these results are reported as odds ratios, which are pretty hard to get your head around. So I found somebody who'd done the calculation of the number needed to treat for benefit and number needed to treat for harm with their confidence intervals. And that sort of, again, emphasizes the fuzziness of the result. So for ECAS-3, the NNT with a 7% absolute difference is 14, but the confidence intervals goes from 7 to 260. That's a really massively wide confidence interval. But the number needed to harm is only 11, with quite a narrow confidence interval, as low as 2 up to 27.
Well, that's really interesting. I'm glad you went on and did that, because I've often said that my confidence in the harm is much greater than my confidence in any benefit, any potential benefit. So that confidence interval, using the NNT to describe that, actually illustrates it quite nicely. But we're getting into the results, so let's get into the results. In ECAS-3, they included 821 patients, so this was more than double the NINS trial, with the mean age of 65 years and 60% were male. What was the key outcome, Daniel?
So after adjusting for baseline imbalances, multiple methods failed to find statistically significant benefits with thrombolysis given 3 to 4.5 hours after stroke onset and confirmed significant increase in harm.
And so rather than getting into the weeds here, because that's the overall picture, I will put the weeds in the paper, and the weeds are Table 3 from this publication that has their multiple adjusted analyses looking at if there was any statistical difference between the two groups, and people can review those. But let's get into talking nerdy, because I think that's really more important, because we've got the overall arching theme of, yep, we've confirmed the harm, but we couldn't seem to confirm any potential benefit from ECAS-3 with this reanalysis. So I'll lead you off, and of course we have my favorite number, 5. So the first one is inter-rater reliability. The inter-rater reliability of an outcome assessment using a modified Rankin scale are moderate at best. A clinical trial has internal validity if and only if the imbalances between groups and biases in the assessment of outcome and chance have been excluded as possible explanations for the differences in outcome. And you mentioned that earlier, but I wanted to put this in as some spaced repetition to understand why that's so important, the imbalances in groups.
The second nerdy point is called the fragility index. And some people might have heard about the fragility index, which is a method to understand how statistically reproducible a study is. And basically, it's the minimum number of patients who would need to have a different outcome to change the p-value from less than 0.05 to greater than 0.05. That is from that term statistically significant to insignificant. Now, that 0.05 threshold is extremely problematic, and I know you've had previous episodes on that, but that's the basis of how you look at the fragility index. So if you have a low fragility index, that means that only a small number of patients would have to have their outcome change for the trial to lose statistical significance. And it's calculated by repeatedly applying Fisher's exact test while successfully reallocating patients one at a time from the favorable outcome group to the other control group. There's actually online fragility index calculators. So the fragility index of the original ECAS3 data is not your favorite number, it's one. So only one patient would have to have a different outcome to change the result of the study. And that fragility, I would say, is consistent with the new reanalysis by ELPA, which actually found no significant benefit for TPA.
Yeah, that fragility index for that was a nice round number, wasn't it? Zero.
Yeah, zero. So, look, there was another big trial, the IST3 trial, was it, which probably everybody knows is the largest randomized controlled trial looking at TPA and acute ischemic stroke out to 6 hours, and which failed to show a benefit in its primary outcome. But in the subgroup of that 3 to 4.5 hour time frame, which is the subject of today's podcast, where they had close to 1,200 patients, it was reported that there was no difference in functional outcomes in those randomized to TPA versus placebo. So that's 32% TPA versus 38% placebo. Odds ratio 0.73 was reported. However, in that paper, in the table, they actually report the confidence interval using a 99% confidence interval. Everybody will know that the conventional reporting approach is the 95% confidence interval. So using that traditional 95% confidence interval results in a statistically significant association with placebo for good functional outcome compared to TPA in that 3 to 4.5 hour time frame in the IST3 study.
I think you brought out a few important points, and I really want to emphasize those. So the first point is we don't want to get too rigid about this dichotomization and this magic p-value of 0.05. We've discussed that before and taking a more Bayesian approach to these types of things. But if they're using that statistic and we're going to use internally their statistics of statistically significant either on one side or the other side of a 0.05, you find that that goes away when you reanalyze this data. The other point is about the IST3, and I think this is really important. Remember, in ECAS3, they had just over 800 patients. In IST3, in the subgroup between 3 and 4.5 hours, they had about 50% more. They had close to 1,200 patients. So a bigger cohort, and in that bigger cohort, TPA versus placebo did better. I want to emphasize that. So 38% had a good outcome versus 32% had the good or favorable outcome with the intervention, the TPA. And then you looked at the table and found this 99% confidence interval and said, wait a minute, why didn't they use the traditional 95? And when you rerun the numbers at 95, oh, that's why maybe they did it that way. Because no longer do you get that crossing of one or that line of no difference when you use the 95%. And it shows a statistical improvement if giving placebo to patients who have an acute ischemic stroke between 3 and 4.5 hours in the cohort of population that was included in IST3. And remember, those patients were older, right? They did include older patients in that cohort. All right, let's get to nerdy point. Now, I am liking this nerdy section with you, Daniel. Oh, I feel very synchronicity or simpatico or something like that. Just a real, oh, you're a nerd like me. Welcome to the nerd zone.
It's a kindred spirit.
It absolutely is a kindred spirit. All right, nerdy point number three is about baseline imbalances, and you mentioned this earlier as well. A strong predictor of how someone will do after a stroke is how bad their stroke symptoms were at presentation. There was important baseline imbalances in stroke between the two groups in the ECAS-3 trial. This is a feature seen before in stroke studies. This was first highlighted by Shea in 2014, who noted that the online version of ECAS-3 paper was changed in 2013 to reflect the actual p-value of 0.003 versus the originally published p-value of 0.03. So it's an order of magnitude difference. The authors had originally defined a significant p-value for these comparisons at less than 0.04. So the correction marked stroke history as a significant difference between the two groups. Clinically, it is known that recurrent strokes also have a worse outcome than first strokes. So the difference in outcomes could be fully explained by baseline imbalances in the populations where there were more previous strokes in the placebo group in the ECAS-3 cohort.
So the next nerdy point really is just re-emphasizing the NINS reanalysis. So the reanalysis of ECAS-3 by ELPA is similar to the reanalysis of NINS by Hoffman and Schreiger, who again found that baseline imbalance in stroke severity was likely responsible for the difference in outcome.
All right, let's bring it home with nerdy point number five. And this one is, time is not brain? In 2018, the authors of the original phrase, quote, time is brain, end of quote, wrote, quote, it is no longer reasonable to believe that the effects of time on the ischemic process represents an absolute paradigm. It is increasingly evident that the volume of injured tissue within a given interval after the estimated time of onset shows considerable variability, in large part due to the beneficial effects of a robust collateral circulation, end of quote.
So the effect of any intervention in stroke is due to factors such as that precise automated measurement of a small ischemic core, a large reversible penumbra, and the use of thrombectomy in highly selected patients associated with detailed consent and coupled with the absence, hopefully, of treatment harm. And the endovascular trials seem to have demonstrated that it's possible to identify a cohort of patients who will benefit from revascularization, which is independent of time of onset, when perfusion imaging is paired with an effective treatment modality. This has not been achieved for thrombolysis in stroke using TPA.
Again, for emphasis, this has not been achieved for stroke thrombolysis using TPA. All right, let's comment on the author's conclusions and compare them to the SGEM's conclusions.
Well, we agree with the conclusions made by Alper et al., who reanalyzed ECAS-3, affirming the lack of benefit for TPA. We also agree that replication studies are needed. And therefore, we do not agree with the conclusion of the original ECAS-3 authors.
All right, how about giving us an SGEM bottom line?
So the SGM bottom line is that reanalysis of the original ECAS3 data does not support the potential benefit of TPA given between 3 and 4.5 hours after onset of stroke symptoms and confirms the known potential harm.
All right, you presented a case at the start of this podcast. Can you resolve the case?
So basically, you provide the man with the latest information on thrombolysis for stroke in that 3 to 4.5 hour time frame, and he decides not to move forward with TPA administration.
And how are you going to take this new reanalysis of ECAS3 data and apply it clinically in your situation?
So this new reanalysis just reemphasizes our skepticism about the thrombolytic literature for acute ischemic stroke, especially in this later time frame. It will modify how we present this information to patients. And on a broader scale, you can decide to discuss this locally within your emergency medicine group and advocate for policymakers to reconsider their recommendations.
And then how are you going to take this? Because this is detailed information. This is complicated. The story of TPA and stroke is a complicated narrative. How are you going to translate that to a conversation at the bedside?
So you need to have a discussion with your patient where basically you're saying you're having a stroke, which is caused by a blood clot in the brain. And there is a drug that has been used in the past to try and dissolve that clot. Now, the older data shows that 7% of people might or may not do better by 3 months, but the drug does cause a potential 10% increase in bleeding in the brain. And 2% more of these people getting this drug will have symptoms of brain bleeding. It is not a life-saving drug, and the same number of people die from this type of stroke as without the drug. The current guidelines say that this medicine may be offered to patients like you. However, just recently, a new look at the original data has raised concerns. When reanalyzing the original data, they found that the harms were the same. However, the potential benefits were unfortunately not confirmed. This means then that we're not confident that this drug will have any benefit for you, but we would be confident to say that this provides you a greater risk from the harm of brain bleeding.
All right, it's time to announce the Keener Contest winner. And last week's winner was Dr. Mark McManus, an emergency consultant from Queensland, Australia. He knew the German thermometrist was Wunderlich, and that eponym of Wunderlich syndrome describes atraumatic intracapsular renal bleeding. Daniel, what question do you have for this episode?
The question for this episode is, who is reported to have said, quote, "We do not know how another trial will turn out, and if we do not come out ahead, we would have a terribly self-inflicted wound. Another study may be a good thing for America, but it wouldn't be a good thing for us."
So if you know who said that quote, send an email to thesgem@gmail.com with Keener in the subject line. The first correct answer will receive a cool skeptical prize. Well, thank you, Daniel, for coming on the SGEM and being such an amazing guest skeptic.
Oh, thanks so much, Ken. I've actually really enjoyed our time together.
All right. Well, there's one last thing to do, and that's to read the SGEM tagline, but you have to do it in your thickest Australian accent.
I haven't got an accent. Remember to be skeptical of anything you learn, even if you heard it on The Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine.
Talk to everyone next time.